One more fella, fellas, one more like that, and I'm through.
These earphones is gone.
1, 2, 3. All right, Doc, let's crank up the October edition.
Since April of 1985, this is the DX Audio Service, a nonprofit organization devoted to the radio listening hobby.
Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for October 2009. This is issue number 295. If you'd like to write to us at the DX Audio Service, the address is 706 McKenzie Drive, spelled MacKenzie, and that's in Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Email is sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. A yearly subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S. and Canadian members in cassette format is $28. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned, or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org, and you can sign up using our PayPal credit card system. Or you can listen on the internet by signing up to E-DXN, that's E-DXN, and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to E-DXN is only $15. You can just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with our PayPal credit card system. You must be able to download and navigate a website to use this service. Does anyone recognize this track from a popular Motown hit? Why not call the DX Audio Service Musings line and tell me the name of the artist, the title, and if you're really good at trivia, the year that this hit came out. Meanwhile, here's Bill Hale with a look at the AM Switch. Bill?
Thank you, Fred, and welcome everyone to AM Switch for the DX Audio Service for October 2009. First of all, call letter changes. KNRS 570 in Salt Lake City, Utah has changed to KACP. 690 KMRX Pueblo, Colorado first changed to KSIP, but then 4 days later changed to KWRP. 700 WJOE Orange Athol, Massachusetts first changed to WVBB, then changed their mind and changed the call to WTUB. 880 KGHT in Sheridan, Arkansas made the switch to KLRG. 1190 WBSL Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, their new call is now WJZD. 1250, a new station in Johnstown, Colorado, has taken the call of KDCO. On 1370 KPCO, Quincy, California switched to KRAC. 1390 WKIC in Hazard, Kentucky, they've switched to WZQQ. 1410 WQBQ Leesburg, Florida switched to WRHB. Also on 1410, this new station in Midlothian, Virginia, their new call WOOK. 1540 WRSM Sumaton, Alabama, they're now known as WKDG. 1550 KSFT St. Joseph, Missouri, now IDs as KESJ. 1600 WDPZ in Dover, Delaware, their new call WAMS. And finally, on 1660, WBMX, Charlotte, North Carolina, they're now known as WBCN. Turning our attention now to facility changes that have taken place over the past month. On 960, WLPR in Pritchard, Alabama, they're now on with 6,000 watts during the day, 32 watts at night, all non-directional, and our designation for that is U1. 1060, KOAI, Van Buren, Arkansas, they're operating under a special temporary authority with 125 watts daytime only after a component failure of their directional tuning unit damaged the transmitter. 1180 WPLX Terrell, Arkansas, they're now on 1180, moving from 1170 with 5,000 watts during the day, 26 watts at night, 3,500 watts during critical hours, three different patterns, and we call that U7, and they built a new two-tower site to do all that. All three patterns are dissimilar, with a day and CH patterns headed toward the northeast, a small night pattern directed toward the southwest. 1330 WKTA, Evanston, Illinois, They're now on with 5,000 daytime watts, 110 watts at night, two patterns, and that's U4. 1410 CFUN in Vancouver, British Columbia. They began testing their new transmitter in late August. Similar testing for CKST 1040 began shortly thereafter. Both stations will be U4 with 50 kilowatts day and night from a new site in Delta, BC. CFUN will radiate directionally from two towers with the same pattern, huge balloons to the northwest day and night, while CKST will be directional from five towers with different patterns day, a kidney-shaped pattern with lobes to the east and northeast and west northwest at and night, the same shape only rotated counterclockwise with the lobes to the north and southwest. Full operation is expected by October. 1430 WION, Ionia, Michigan. They're now on with 4,700 watts during the day, 330 watts at night, U2, that's directional nighttime only. For WION, it's a reduction of 300 watts during the day, and that affords them the opportunity to go non-directional and pick up some coverage to the east, south, and west, which they had none before. 1480 KRAE, Cheyenne, Wyoming, they're now on with 1,000 watts during the day, 72 watts at night from their new 200-foot tower. 1490 KWED, Woodville, Texas, new station is on with a kilowatt day and night. Woodville is about 80 miles northeast of Houston. 1510 KCKK, Littleton, Colorado, they're now on with 10,000 watts daytime, 25,000 watts at night. Kind of an unusual situation, but that's the way it goes. Two different patterns, and as I said, they're now on with those new facilities. 1520 WCHE, Westchester, Pennsylvania, construction permit for D4, I'll get to that in a minute, 1,000 watts during the day, 800 watts during critical hours, adding that CH operation is now on. Now, D4 means they're a daytime-only station, but they have two patterns because they have that critical hours designation. The CH pattern replicates the day pattern with a large lobe to the northeast and a smaller lobe to the southwest. 1550 KIVA, Albuquerque, New Mexico, they're now on with 50,000 watts during the day, 27 watts at night, all non-directional, or U1. 1580 WNTF in Bithlow, Florida, they're now on with 10,000 watts daytime only directional. Our designation for that? D3. They added two 140-foot towers to their original single stick to produce the new pattern, which directs the bulk of the signal to the northwest, with smaller lobes to the northeast, southeast, and southwest. Two new stations were granted this past month, 1400 in Vernal, Utah. They've been granted 1,000 watts day and night. Similar facilities in Hellendale, California on 1450, and that's a second new station this month. Some actions, 540 WETC, Wendell, Zebulon, North Carolina. They've been granted a construction permit for 10,000 watts days, 500 watts at night, U4. The new day pattern throws a large lobe to the southeast with a smaller lobe to the northwest, no change in those nighttime facilities for them. 610 CHNC in New Carlisle, Quebec. They've been granted an extension to leave the air until 1 December of this year as they're having signal issues with their new replacement FM station. 790 WAEB, Allentown, Pennsylvania, licensed for U4, 3600 daytime, 1500 watts at night, is now operating at reduced power levels, or up to 25% of those powers non-directional. We'll get to more on that at the end of the column. 790 CIGM, Sudbury, Ontario, is now simulcasting with their FM station on 93.5. 810 in Brighton, Colorado, KLVZ. CP has been granted for 10,000 watts during the day, 430 watts at night, two different patterns, U4. The new day pattern directs a large circular plot to the southwest, while the nighttime facilities remain the same. 1010 KXEN, St. Louis, Missouri. CP has been granted for U4, 50,000 watts daytime, 420 watts at night, changing the nighttime power a tad. Along with a slight reduction in that night power, they've gone from 4 to 5 towers, making some changes to the pattern. As a matter of fact, that pattern is highly directional to the southwest. 1070 CBI in Sydney, Nova Scotia. They've been granted an extension until 9 July 2010 to leave the air as they are having signal issues with their new replacement FM station. On 1100 KWWN, Las Vegas, Nevada, CP has been granted for 22,000 watts daytime, 2,000 watts at night, U4, increasing their daytime power by 10%. 1150 WHBY, Kimberly, Wisconsin, they've been granted auxiliary facilities of 83 watts, day and night, non-directional. Also on 1150 CHGM, Gaspé, Quebec, they've been granted an extension to leave the air until 1 December of 2009 as they're having signal issues with their new replacement FM station. Seems we're having a lot of trouble up in Canada with those replacement FMs. 1190, a new station in Whitehall, Arkansas. They've been granted to change their city of license from Pine Bluff to Whitehall, change the facilities to 25,000 watts days, 350 watts at night, U4, and move the antenna site. 1210 KQEQ, Fowler, California. They've been granted a CP for 5,000 watts, daytime only, directional, moving to and using three towers of the KXEX 1550 four-tower site in Herndon, California. The new pattern will be almost a circle directed to the southeast. 1220 WSRQ, Sarasota, Florida. This currently silent station has been granted a special temporary authorization for 150 watts, daytime only, using a 145-foot vertical long wire. WSRQ was granted a CP for U4 1,000 daytime watts, 39 watts at night, adding the night service, but has had a problem with the landowner of the property on which their tower was located. First, the owner refused to allow the proposed second tower and now has terminated their lease. So in order to resume service, they requested this low power while they're looking for a new tower site. 1320 KSCR, Eugene, Oregon. They've been granted 600 watts daytime, 40 watts at night, all non-directional, co-locating with KKNX 840 and KLZS 1450. Since the new tower is almost twice the height of the old one, these lower power levels are necessary in order to serve the same coverage area. 1370 KRVZ, Springerville, Arizona. They've been granted 10,000 watts during the day, 22 watts at night, all non-directional, U1, along with a move from 1400. 1380 WKDM, New York, New York, licensed for 5,000 watts day and night, U4. WKDM has a CP for 5,000 daytime watts, 13,000 watts at night, but since the four-tower array is located in the vicinity of the Meadowlands in New Jersey, which is undergoing massive amounts of construction at a project called Xanadu, employing several large cranes, WKDM cannot do a proper proof of performance. They've been granted a special temporary authority to operate with U4, 5,000 daytime watts, 13,000 watts at night, with parameters out of the specified tolerance until the Xanadu project is completed. This is late 2010, so expect some variances in their new nighttime pattern, which all is directed toward the southeast. 1510 WJKN, Jackson, Michigan. They've been granted special temporary authorization to continue operating with 1,000 watts daytime, non-directional, from a long wire antenna. They're actually licensed for 5,000 daytime watts, but they're having problems, so they're on that long wire with reduced power. And finally, 1660 WWRU, Jersey City, New Jersey. They're licensed for U4, 10,000 watts day and night. They have a CP slightly loosening the small lobe headed to the northeast, but due to the same reasons we talked about in the WKDM Special Temporary Authority previously, they are operating on the CP until late 2010. No applications have been submitted for new stations this past month. Some dismissals, 580 KSAZ, Marana, Arizona. Their application to move to Queen Creek has been dismissed. 870 KRLA, Glendale, California. Their application for U4, 50,000 watts daytime, 32,000 watts at night has been dismissed. 1410 WJUS, Marion, Alabama. They had a CP for 1,100 watts daytime, 16 watts at night, moving to Selma. That's been dismissed. 1340 WJAM, Selma, Alabama. Application to move to Thomaston is out the window. 1560 KLTI, Springfield, Missouri. They had a CP to move to Macon, Missouri on 660, but that also has been canceled by the FCC. Some license cancellations along with call letter deletions, 790 CIGM, Sudbury, Ontario. They've moved to 93.5 megahertz with a CHR format, and they're now known as Hot FM. CIGM was the last AM station licensed to Sudbury. And 850 CKBA, Athabasca, Alberta. They've moved to 94.1, remaining classic hits, calling themselves The River. Some more simulcasting actions as we've been getting in more and more of this as time rolls on here. 550 WSAU, Wausau, Wisconsin, is now carried on WSAU FM 99.9 in Rudolph. 570 KACP, Salt Lake City, Utah, is now being simulcast on KTMY 105.7 in Centerville, Utah. 660 KGDP, Oilville, California, simulcasting on KWVE FM 107.9, San Clemente. 1230 CJNL Merritt, BC. They're now parallel with the new CKMQ FM 101.1 in Merritt and will continue until 1 December when it will begin relaying CHNL 610 in Kamloops. 1240 WJLX Jasper, Alabama is being carried on translator W268BM 101.5. 1280 WHTK Rochester, New York, they're now parallel with WROO 107.3 South Bristol Township, New York. 1290 KUOA Siloam Springs, Arkansas, they can be heard on K250 AX 97.9 in Bentonville, also on K287 AN 105.3 Fayetteville, both of those cities, of course, in Arkansas. 1490 WKDR Berlin, New Hampshire, this new station is on, carrying the hot AC programming of WXXS 102.3. Those details on that new station, by the way, were in last month's issue. 1550 WJIL Jacksonville, Illinois is now being heard on W275 BM 102.9 Lancaster, Illinois. And 1560 WINT Melbourne, Florida, they're now heard on WSJZ 95.9 Sebastian, Florida. Well, some items from here and there. Returning to the airwaves this month, WCKL 560 Catskill, New York. KGDP, Oildale, California on 660. They've got Contemporary Christian, as we heard on KWVE 107.9. KWRP 690 Pueblo, Colorado is back on with a classic hits and talk format. KIPA 1060 Hilo, Hawaii returns with an ethnic format. WDGR 1210 Dahlonega, Georgia, they're back on with ethnic. WDCR 1340 Hanover, New Hampshire returns to the airwaves with Dartmouth College Radio. I guess that's what DCR means. WKIC 1390 Hazard, Kentucky, also back on. Reported a silent KSIP 690 Pueblo, Colorado, pending the sale of that station. WEEL 710 Dothan, Alabama. WAMO 860 Millvale, Pennsylvania, along with their FM WAMO FM 106.7, WKIQ 1240 Eustis, Florida, WPBQ Flowood, Mississippi, also on 1240, KVWG 1280 Pearsall, Texas is off, WAVG 1400 Jacksonville, North Carolina is silent, as is WYIS 1410 McRae, Georgia, WLET 1420 Toccoa, Georgia, WTJV 1490 DeLand, Florida. We'll have a little bit more on that a little later. KWUD 1490 in Woodville, Texas. WPGR 1510 Monroeville, Pennsylvania is off. And WAZX 1550 Smyrna, Georgia. They were reported as back on, but they were only on for a day so they wouldn't lose their license. They've now filed for another silent STA, Special Temporary Authority. Some fines, I love these. WGBN 1150 New Kensington, Pennsylvania. They were fined $5,000 for willfully and repeatedly violating rules by failing to operate its station in a manner which complies with the terms of the station authorization, and that could cover a myriad of things. Also, they were operating a studio transmitter link on an unauthorized frequency and failing to maintain radio issues and program lists in the station's public inspection file. Also fined WKLJ 1150 Sparta, Wisconsin, along with their FM station, $8,800 for failure to reduce power at sunset, plus other violations. WIFI 1460 Florence, New Jersey, fined $18,400 for operating with excessive power, failure to maintain an operational EAS system, which is emergency alert, and failing to maintain an effective enclosure at the base of the Wi-Fi tower. KKAY 1590 White Castle, Louisiana has been fined $1,500 for failure to apply for license renewal in a timely manner. Well, last issue, we reported KDOW 1220 Palo Alto, California was granted a construction permit for U4 50,000 watts day and night from a new transmitter site. El Tobaya reports that KDOW was told by the city of Hayward, California, which is the location of the new site, that the placement of the new towers they proposed is unacceptable and the station cannot build on the land. We'll keep an eye on this for you as things develop. Well, speaking of towers, part one, the 327-foot tower of WTJ V1490 DeLand, Florida, was toppled by a Jeep which was carrying fans following a high school football game. The Jeep caught one guy wire and down came the tower. No injuries were reported, but three vehicles were damaged by the falling structure. WTJV has applied for a silent STA, stating they are working at putting some sort of an auxiliary facility on the air. In the meantime, 1490 just lost a bit of nighttime hash between Orlando and Daytona Beach. Speaking of towers, part two. One of the five 350-foot towers of WAEB 790 Allentown, Pennsylvania, was intentionally toppled on Friday morning, September 2nd. Guy wires were cut, police say, and the station has applied for an STA. And speaking of towers, part three. 5 hours after the WAEB incident, it appears that vandals took down two of the KRKO-1380 Everett's four new towers in rural Snohomish, Washington. There's been an ongoing environmental battle for years over the placement of the new towers. And referring to last issue's item about WNVR 1030 receiving the okay to resume licensed operation after being off the air, Neil Cazaros sends word that they haven't used their 120-watt nighttime authorization in a couple of years. That makes me wonder why a station would go all to the expense of buying a new transmitter, erecting the towers, and not use some of their authorization. Well, according to the FCC, as at the end of August, there were 4,789 AM stations and over 10,500 various classes of FM stations licensed. How many have you heard? Well, that's going to wrap things up for this month. My thanks go out to Sean Axelrod, Wheeler Wheels Canover, Wayne Heinen, Dean McIntyre, Dave Schmidt, and Stan Morse for contributing tips and news so I may impart them to you. Now here's my buddy, John Bunker.
Well, thanks very much, Bill Hale, and hello, everybody. Welcome to the travelogue portion of the DX audio service once again. And say, before we go any further, I've got to be fair to a station. I'm going to pick up where I left off last month, because I made it sound as though the station in Scranton, Pennsylvania, for all any of us knew, just never bothers to ID. Well, that's not quite the case. Let's hear how they really do it.
Don't ask me why. WARM, Scranton, serving Wilkes-Barre, Scranton, and the Poconos, where news comes first.
Okay, I just thought having made it sound like they didn't know how to ID, I thought I ought to correct that. Well, hey, it's great to be back with you once again. We have three more travelogues to go, and we're just scattering them all over the country to make sure that we don't leave anybody out here. And to prove our point, why don't we start in the far northeast corner of the United States, up in the state of Maine, on the October 2009 DX Audio Service Travelogue.
WLAM, Lewiston Auburn's news station.
Live from Lewiston Auburn, this is Newswatch at 11. Some Cuban leaders have been sentenced to death for drug trafficking.
Well, that doesn't sound all that pleasant, does it? I guess. Well, now, this next cut is just the ID, a little bit of the music they play, of the station that sent me my second confirmed letter of verification. By the way, the first one I ever got was from CFRB in Toronto. But this station here played music that my parents didn't like, and therefore, of course, I would listen to it occasionally. That's when I was about 8 or 9 years old. It was operating under the call letters WMFF back there.
WIRY Plattsburgh, 87 degrees, 2 o'clock.
States given more power to decide who gets an abortion, and the Supreme Court upholds some government-sponsored religious displays. With Mutual News, I'm Becky Bailey in Washington.
Very good, Becky. Now, in 1952, I moved to New York City to continue some educational stuff, and while there, lived at the West 23rd Street YMCA. That's right off 8th Avenue in the Chelsea part of Manhattan.
And there was a beautiful high-fidelity recording studio that some fellas had set up who were all attending the same graduate studies that I was going to. We had lots of people coming in over a period of a week, and we decided to ask one question. What radio station would you tune to if some big news item were breaking? And from New Yorkers, there was only one answer.
W-O-Y. Your first station for news, first in talk.
Radio 710 W-O-Y.
Yes, that's right. It really, you know, WOR was the first all-talk station that I remember ever hearing. So it was logical if you want news, you don't go to a music station, you go to a talk station. So it worked. Well, now, you know, several times over the life of this travelogue series of programs I put together for you once a month, the subject of building your own radio station has come up. You'll recall that. And here's another one. Turns out, back in the middle 1980s, yeah, it's kind of up to date for this program, I know, but about 1988, two fellas in Buffalo, New York, had a big collection of oldies music, oldies rock and roll music. And they went to a radio station program director and said, "We'll be disc jockeys on your station." He said, No, your recordings aren't good enough for our FM station. Well, it turns out that the FM station, WPHD, had an AM station that they really didn't know what to do with. They didn't want it. And the two fellas learned of that and went back to the director and said, "Well, how about letting us take over the AM station? We'll sell our own commercials and we'll see how it goes." The program director said, "Okay, let's do it." And thus was born this next station.
WGK Buffalo.
And would you believe it? These two guys ran the station 24 hours a day using tape, of course, through the night. And they kept it on the air for over a year, into 1989. And it's since changed. It was at 1400 on the dial, by the way, in Buffalo. The station's still there. Oh, and I should tell you, the call sign is WGKT. KT14, they called it. Okay, on our travels, 35, 40 years ago, I had occasion to be driving along the northern border of Ohio on our way toward Indiana, and it occurred to me that at least one of our children in the car had never been in the state of Michigan. And it turns out further that there is one exit off the interstate that is like 100 feet from the state of Michigan. So we exited there, went in, turned around in the parking lot, and I said, "Okay, kids, you've now been in Michigan." And the thing that made the whole business so memorable to me was that the place I made the U-turn in Michigan was in the parking lot of WSTR in Sturgis.
The latest hits.
The greatest hits for Sturgis and all of Michiana.
WSTR FM and AM, Sturgis Coldwater.
Okay, very nice. Now, like me, I'm sure that when you look down lists of call letters, some of them stand out at you. Some of them form words, and that makes them a lot easier to remember. And here we are in Michigan, so I can't leave Michigan without playing for you one of those words.
The news leader.
The Sunday Show, a three-hour West Michigan tradition. I'm Rob Sanford, and I hope you can join us between 8 and 11 Sunday morning for some fun and thought-provoking conversation.
1300 WOOD.
This is the NBC Radio Network. I'm Micah Johnson.
Well, yes, indeed, WOOD does stand out in a list, does it not? Oh, and speaking of that, let's take a quick review of the Canadian way of assigning call letters. Starts with a C, and then there are, what, six second letters that are assigned to Canada. B, F, H, I, J, K. But there's another one, and that's the letter V. And I always wondered how they got away with the letter V when it should start with the letter C. Well, Newfoundland found a way to do it.
You're listening to stations of the VOCM radio service. 590 VOCM St. John's. 850 CHVO Carbonear. 710 CKVO Clarendon. 560 CHCM Marystown. 650 CKGA Gander. 620 CKCM Grand Falls. And 1240 CKIM Bay Vert.
It's 9 o'clock. Doctor and the Medics are next. VOCM color weather radar now. And this hour over the Twin Cities, still picking up that light scatter precipitation, although nothing.
Okay, I guess it's safe to imagine that VOCM does not carry live baseball games. After all, between innings, what would the announcer say? Let's pause a minute and a half for station identification down the line. Well, maybe not. Now, if you ever get a chance to visit the University of Wisconsin main campus in Madison, do find your way to the studios of WHA. That's the station that originates programs for the entire state of Wisconsin, a very involved network of stations, and it's all NPR-sounding material. I can tell you that when I visited there, completely unannounced, they gave me a total tour of the studios and actually sat and talked to me a little of the history of WHA. There's a mural on the wall. I mean, this is a station deserving of great respect.
Getting back together again, I trust, tomorrow at 8 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
97 AM, WHA, Madison.
It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Ryan Mulcahy. There's a chance of showers and thunderstorm activity in eastern Wisconsin's forecast this afternoon.
All right. Now, compare that very staid sound with the absolute mayhem at 570 on your dial in New York City. How this fella can do this, maybe he's on something.
Come on home.
Baby, it's you, the Shirelles. 21 and a half after 7 there, 62 degrees in New York. And let's see, I played that there for Janice and Tom. Donna and Pucky, Pam and Wayne, and all the kids over there in Terrace Avenue. And we've stopped taking calls for the BMR correspondents because, wow, we're just backlogged. And Tom Seaton of the Franklin School let us know they beat Aaron in softball 15-1, 16 victories for a two-year period. Nutty! And we have a name and a claimant winner there. Jackie Chastel of Forest Hills, a name and claimant winner on that first call from Queens. And she won Baby, It's You by the Shirelles.
WMCA.
97 to 11. And here's number 17 on the Good Guy Survey.
It's my party.
And by the way, between all his records, the patter is very much the same. Wow. Type A personality, I would say. This last cut we have for you today, it takes place about 150 to 200 miles south of where I'm sitting near Tampa, Florida.
Buenas tardes, Cuba. Estás escuchando Radio Martí. Siempre contigo, 24 horas en tu compañía. Radio Martí, por el derecho de cada hombre a ser libre, a recibir información y diseminarla, a buscar su verdad y enarbolarla, en medio de otros hombres que se la respetan.
That's right, 1180, Radio Martí, right into Cuba.
Skating, skating, celebrating, the bargaining down a hill. Build a snowman, take a sleigh ride, grow some chestnuts by a fireside. Who you find is a great time of year.
What? Leave Tampa, Florida to go to New York for the winter? Are you mindless? Mark's next, everybody. We'll see you in November.
Thanks, John. And what great snapshots you present. And what a tough act it is to follow the travelogue. Well, we're going to resume our own journey through radio history this month. You may recall that back in spring and ending in June, we brought you year by year into the 1930s. In the development of radio stations. Today, we begin a closer look at how the radio networks were being connected and how they spread across the country. And next month, thanks to your comments about our June edition and its shortwave stories, we'll drill down into how shortwave and medium wave radio was used as a propaganda tool in and around World War II. In the 1930s, networks had become big business in this country, with NBC Red, NBC Blue, and CBS spreading from coast to coast, each with 80 to 120 affiliated stations. There were other startup attempts, for example, Ed Wynn tried to light up the Amalgamated Network in 1933. It lasted but 6 months. In 1934, a fledgling Eastern network that had been called the Quality Station Group changed its name to the Mutual Broadcasting System. Its first success was the Lone Ranger, originated at WXYZ Detroit. When it began, Mutual consisted of only four stations, including WGN and WLW. 50 to 60 additional stations were added, and Mutual, too, sought westward expansion. Interesting, the idea of westward expansion. We take coast-to-coast radio so much for granted today, but until the mid-1930s, there really was no coast-to-coast full-time service. NBC had founded the Orange Network along the West Coast to complement its Red and Blue networks. CBS established a West Coast network, and Mutual eventually collaborated with the Don Lee Network. But the problem was connectivity with the rest of the country. At first, these networks provided regional news from west of the Rockies, with the occasional East Coast network feed provided by telephone call. You see, the long lines of AT&T stopped just past Denver, and in order to get to the West Coast, the networks had to use semi-primitive telephone connections. Radio programs from the East Coast were typically sent by commercial courier via the established airline routes. Recordings on 16-inch disc were handed to the West Coast headquarters. By 1936, the telephone company was ready to provide full-time transmission over the Rockies. This was, however, a one-way path with limited capacity. Faced with the need to receive broadcasts from the left coast, the networks asked AT&T to incorporate a new system called a quick reversible circuit. Under this arrangement, the operation of a single key in each of the AT&T offices would reverse the direction of every amplifier in the line between Los Angeles and Chicago. Thus, in the space of about 15 seconds, the lines feeding from New York and Chicago to the West Coast could be reversed and the signals flowing in the opposite direction. This reversible circuit was still being used during NBC's latter-day monitor programs of the 1950s. Old-timers will recall hearing the monitor anchor tell us there'd be a short pause for circuit reversal when NBC wanted to quickly switch to the West Coast. With the West Coast thus connected to the rest of the country, it became economical to produce national programs in Hollywood. Big Hollywood names like Al Jolson, Bob Hope, Clark Gable were regularly heard on NBC after that year, broadcasting from Hollywood. There's a whole series of stories on chain breaks and how the NBC chimes were sounded, whether they were sounded from the East Coast, the West Coast, from individual stations. It all makes good reading on the Internet. And that's the story of how the networks expanded to the West Coast. Initially, neither major network had done much in national news broadcasting. NBC saw itself performing a noble mission in creating the first national network, but at the same time it was reluctant to appear too powerful, too influential. The passage of the Radio Act of 1927 had come amid congressional concern that a single corporation, namely RCA, might dominate the flow of information. Radio also had not heretofore been considered much of a threat to newspapers. In the early 1930s, however, radio variety shows began to soak up advertising dollars at an alarming rate. The newspapers reacted by eliminating radio listings and stories and trying to choke off the wire services. The first volley in the famous press radio war was fired when the newspapers set strict new rules for wire services, the most irritating of which was that radio could not use wire stories until newspapers were on the streets. Well, broadcasters reacted by simply doing their own news collecting, and the newspapers then offered a compromise in the form of a proposed press radio bureau, which was established to feed wire service bulletins to the networks. They were written slightly differently, with a different format and style, so that the radio stations and the newspapers didn't appear to be copying each other. But even before that press radio bureau was operational, radio was discovering its own capabilities. Networks were forming their own radio news bureaus. And this worked so well that the Press Association set up an outfit called Press Radio News. All users contributed. They would feed the networks a certain amount of canned news daily. This is evocative of the television satellite news gathering cooperatives of the 80s and 90s. Well, eventually, of course, the furor of the press radio war went away, as most brouhahas tend to do. Radio stations and networks became competitive news sources and remained so, competing with the newspapers from a strong position, until the radio consolidation of the 1980s and the de-emphasis of news as a priority. There was one other event of import that was to shape the radio dial at the end of the 30s. That was the intended reconstruction of the frequency assignment tables in the United States. Work began on the restructuring in the mid-1930s. The treaty, called the North American Regional Broadcasting Agreement, was actually signed in 1931. Among the United States, Canada, Mexico, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, and Haiti. It's rumored that Mexico actually never signed the NARBA, instead using agreement letters with the United States to protect certain stations. While the treaty was signed in 1939, it was not to be effective until March 1941. NARBA provided for new classes of operating channels, new clear channel assignments among the signatories. Some countries that never had them now had clear channels. There would be an expansion of the broadcast band to 1,600 kilocycles, new frequency separations in every radio market, and the establishment of the six graveyard channels we know today, 1230, 1240, 1340, 1400, 1450, and 1490. We've been through the NARBA details ad nauseum over several band scan columns, so we won't belabor it, but there were a couple of interesting stories, because while entire groups of stations were moved by a fixed number of channels, there were many other stations that were treated as individual cases. The block shifts of stations en masse either were none, plus 10, plus 20, plus 30, plus 40 kilohertz, or, in some cases, minus 10 kilohertz. These changes accommodated the insertion of foreign clears at numerous positions, as well as the wholesale move of U.S. clear channels on 1460 through 1490 to 1500 through 1530, and the wholesale move of all the locals who had been on 1500 to one of the graveyard channels, 1490. Clear channels assigned to other countries included 740, 800, 860, 900, 1220, and maybe of greatest import, 540. The new U.S. clears now extended from 1500 to 1530, and there were new foreign clears added above that spot from 1540 to 1580. 1590 and 1600 became new regional channels. Now, we mentioned same city frequency separation. Prior to 1941, the separation was 50 kilocycles. That meant that stations had to be five dial spots away from each other in the same market. This restriction on same-city separation was narrowed now to 40 kilocycles. Most of the station reassignments were by the table method we talked about, where groups of stations moved a specific distance up or down the dial. Several new Class 1B channels were created. Provision was also made for later Class 1Bs, and some non-table moves were done in order to effect greater separation from new Mexican clears. Of all the U.S. stations moved by NARBA, only about 86 were not moved by this block table method. These were the individual cases in which some stations were reshuffled and reclassified as to power and protection status. And we'll learn more about individual cases when we present our State of the Stations report in coming months. After 1941, the high-powered regionals were reclassified as Class 1B clears, and while some may have operated 50 kilowatts day, 10 kilowatts night non-directional, every one of them, and that's 1500 to 1530, eventually installed a directional antenna for night operation with 50 kilowatts. And as to the reduced market separation to 40 kilocycles, additional stations were dropped into several markets, most particularly New York, but some others as well. Also, the clears were laid out without respect to adjacent channel interference from or to distant markets. And if you ever wondered why the New York Metro, then including Newark, had 660, 710, 770, and 880, while the Chicago Metro had stations precisely 10 kilohertz higher, 670, 720, 780, and 890, it turned out to be a mistake. The mutual destruction to nighttime service was predictable. That interference is and has been going on for decades. The presence of IBOC is merely exacerbating an interference process within the primary service areas of many Class A's. There are fascinating details hidden among the 1941 NARBA frequency shuffle. Just one example, 1050 had been a U.S. clear channel until NARBA gave it to Mexico, thereby forcing KNX to move to 1070. By the table method, KNX should have moved to 1080, but 1080 was reassigned to solve the time-sharing problem between WTIC and WBAL. WTIC took over 1080, WBAL went to 1090. Just as 1190 was used to solve the WOWO WWVA time-sharing problem. WOWO took 1190, WWVA got 1170. And by the way, lest I forget, we owe Scott Feibusch and Peter Haas some credit for the information presented in this report. I sometimes quote them verbatim, not to make me look smart, but to help the story and give you a better understanding. But for now, Fred's giving us the eyes, so we need to pull the plug. Next month, we'll tell you the fascinating story of the medium wave and short wave stations enlisted in the propaganda efforts of World War II. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. Hope to see you in 30 days, and until then, good listening, DXers.
It's time for a pattern change. Or at least to flip over your tape for more of the DX Audio Service.